listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, we're celebrating the talented creators and performers who worked on the groundbreaking Broadway musical and now movie, Hamilton. First up, three-time Tony winner and four-time Grammy Award-winning musical director and orchestrator Alex Lacamoire. You may be familiar with some of his work on stage.
Shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot.
I try to speak, but nobody can hear, so I...
For our listeners who weren't already singing along, those were songs from the musicals In the Heights, Hamilton, and Dear Evan Hansen, shows that Alex helped bring to life. He also served as the executive music producer for the FX series Fosse Verdon, which follows the lives of Broadway legends Bob Fosse and his muse and love, dancer, singer, and actress Gwen Verdon. Alex joined us last summer to talk about his career in musical theater, as well as his new projects for TV and film. I began by asking Alex when he first started writing music.
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. I feel like it probably happened maybe around the tail end of junior high, the beginning of high school. Somewhere in there, I remember clearly getting a hold of a keyboard sequencer, which at the time was, a way that you would sit on a keyboard and build tracks. So you would like play an entire song, just the bass track, and then lay the drum part on top of that, and then lay down the electric guitar part on top of that. So I probably did that with like Billy Joel songs and Rush songs. So I think in that act, I was actually like realizing, okay, how does a bass guitar function in a song? What does a guitar do? If horns come in, like what are the chords you play? When do they come in? What's their volume? So I think in there, I've always had a curiosity about separate instruments and how they work as a whole. So I feel like somewhere in there when I started to really be able to like think in individual sounds, that's when it started to really kind of take shape for me.
When you gave a commencement address, which was lovely at Berkeley.
Thank you.
And during the commencement address, you recognized an elementary school educator who recognized your talent and that there was something in you. And I'd like to play a little bit of that.
Sure.
So one day during lunch, Principal Brady, she walks into the noisy cafeteria past the rambunctious students, and she makes her way directly to 9-year-old Alex. She asks him how he's doing. Okay, he replies. She says, I hear you play the piano. Yeah, he says. And she motions to the upright piano in the far end corner of the assembly hall. And she asks, would you like to play something? And I look at her. And I feel this sense of occasion, a calling.
Why did you want to share that particular story with those students graduating from Berklee School of Music?
I think what resonated for me about that moment is just music felt like a way that I knew how to communicate. Music was able to be something that words could not for me. I just had a hard time connecting. I'm not sure what it was. And maybe it was just feeling different, you know, feeling like I couldn't find people who could relate to me on a certain level. But yet here was a way that I could communicate without actually using language, with just using sounds. And for whatever reason, I suppose maybe growing up, maybe my parents or my teachers had kind of instilled this sense in me that there was something about the way I made music that was different than other people at a higher level, if you will, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So that just became something that I felt like, oh, this is something that I can do that other people cannot. And for whatever reason, because I had seen in prior instances music bring joy to people, whether it was people dancing to a song, whether it was the way music made me feel when I would listen to the radio, or whether it was me playing a song at a recital and seeing what kind of response that would get. Just for whatever reason, I felt like music was a way that I would be able to just show a different side of me. And, you know, music is such an ephemeral thing, right? Unless I'm at a piano, like I can talk all day with you about what it is that I do, but I find actually like putting, showing and not telling is a very powerful thing. And so there was just something about that instance where all of a sudden things just clicked for me. And then all of a sudden I found that, oh, there's a way that my music can allow me to excel. Because really from that point forward, it became, oh, let's ask Alex to accompany the singers. Oh, you know, let's ask Alex to be a solo singer in this thing. You know, it became a way for me to actually collaborate with people, and it just got me out of doing studies in a way, because like that's really all I wanted to be doing. It's just like playing piano and making music. So it just I think that's really what started the path for me to realize, oh, there's a way that using this thing that was comes naturally to me, here's how I can actually maybe go places with it.
I'm also hearing that it became solidified as your identity.
Yeah.
Like you are a musician. You don't
I am
just play
a musician.
I am a musician.
Exactly right. And I'm lucky that I knew that early on. I know there's people that spend their whole lives looking for what it is that fulfills them and what their purpose is. But for whatever reason, it was just written in some stone somewhere. There is just something about the way I processed music and what it meant to me and how I recreated it that I've been able to say I'm a musician since from an early age. Every job I've ever had has been music related. Like, even when I was the camp counselor at a summer camp, I was like the music teacher.
Music guy.
at the camp. So that's why, yeah, it was just always my in.
My guest is Alex Lacamoire. You have a hearing loss, yes?
I do.
Can you tell us, I don't know the story behind your hearing loss. I just know that you do.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Please. No, I don't talk about it too often. I don't know if the hearing loss was caused by anything. I have a feeling I was born with it. Mm-hmm. But at a young age, probably around 4 years old, my mom would just notice that, wow, Alex is sitting really close to the television set. Mm-hmm. Or, wow, Alex isn't noticing when I'm calling his name from the other room, or Alex is asking me to repeat things. And they decided to give me a hearing test. And then they realized that I have a deficiency in my hearing. So if you look at a chart, the best way to describe it is, you know, there's a chart that goes from left to right that shows you, you can draw a line from left to right that shows what a normal hearing what a normal, quote unquote, normal person's hearing is like. And it's based on frequencies. There's low frequencies and then mid-range and then high frequencies. Low frequencies are like, you know, train rumbles. Mid frequencies is speech. High frequencies are things like consonants and you know, high symbols, triangles, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. So if you look at my left to right, it kind of like goes straight, and then it goes down and then dips. So I don't have a lot of high frequencies. So when people are whispering, if I don't wear my hearing aids, I won't pick up on consonants. It'll just sound a little blurry to me. So that's just been the way I perceive sound all my life. And so I wear hearing aids that correct that. They amplify the high-end frequencies so that I can understand people better. So when I'm not wearing my hearing aids, like, make no mistake, I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself deaf at all. When I'm not wearing them, I can hear people. It's just harder for me to hear. And the way I describe it to people, you know, if you and I listen to music, like, we're listening to the same piece of music. Mm-hmm. I would just have a slightly different perception of it. And, you know, the easiest way to explain it is that I probably hear it at a softer volume than you do. So if we were to kind of adjust the knob, and, you know, you probably, I would turn it up and be like, oh, this sounds great. And you might be, yo, this is way too loud. Can we turn this down? So it's just it's relative. But what's helpful is that because I've had, my hearing itself has not changed since I was a child. If you look at charts from when I was 4 and charts from last week, they are the same. So I've learned to compensate for that. So, you know, because I've been experiencing music in a certain way for so long, when I make music now, I'm trying to make it match this sound that is already familiar to me, if that makes sense. So I've learned to kind of work around this deficiency.
It's so interesting that you said your parents noticed. It happened to a friend of mine.
Oh, really?
That her kid, they just thought he was strong-willed because he didn't respond to them when they asked him to do things.
Sure.
And he had funny names for all his friends.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
It was the grandmother who had taught kids that I think it's his hearing. And they realized that, like, you know, Flipberg was actually his friend, like, Philip.
Oh,
he had just made up all these names.
Yeah, yeah.
And because he was a little, you know, he didn't call them when they called. They were just like, Connor is a character.
Yep. That was just his perception then.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. Because, yeah, I feel like it definitely has affected my speech as well. Like, I used to have a lisp when I was a kid.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. There's a way that I hear sound that, you know, when I watch TV, I usually will watch closed captioning because it helped me follow mm-hmm. along the stories a little better. But you know what I did last night? I saw My Fair Lady, Lincoln Center, which was fantastic. And the latest thing now is this app called GallaPro, and I'm so into it. Have you heard of this?
No, what is this?
You basically, when you get to a show, what you do is you log on to their Wi-Fi, you download this app, and as the show happens, you can put your phone on your lap and you see the lyrics and the text and the script basically flashing on your phone while you're watching the show. So then now I don't miss anything. It's awesome.
Wow.
And that's a very new development. That was not around 2 years ago. So I'm super into it. More and more shows are doing it. But it's just so nice that there's now ways to kind of like, you know, get around something that might have been an impediment.
It's interesting how technology has changed theater and musical theater.
Yep.
I've talked to a couple of different people from Will Chase from Kiss Me, Kate.
Sure.
And there's a moment in the where he whispers.
Mm-hmm.
50 years ago, they couldn't have done
that. Oh, no way.
You know, it's also the actors have all these different opportunities because of technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
In your Twitter bio, Alex, you describe yourself as a music guy.
Music guy, yeah.
So let's talk about Fosse Verdon.
Sure.
How are you the music guy for Fosse Verdon?
I guess for this particular project, I would like to think that from the creative vantage point, I was probably the one that got to make the final decisions, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
From the perspective of collaborating with our producers, collaborating with the directors, interfacing with the musicians and the band and all that stuff, just really kind of making sure that all the music for the show was handled, quote unquote, mm-hmm. Whether it was making sure we had enough background singers to sing ensemble for a song, making sure that the person who has to sing the Liza Minnelli song is giving it a performance that captures the spirit of what Liza sang back in 1972 for Cabaret, for example. It also involved writing original music. It involved making sure that the ins and the outs of the songs felt fluid, mm-hmm. making sure that the music in the show told a story. So I guess it was kind of just having my eye on all things music related in the show.
You were the music guy.
I'm the music guy.
It's, you know, it's interesting about it because it's, you know, when you think of Fosse Verdon, you think dancers.
Sure.
But obviously dancers need music. So the music is equally as important in a show about the life and careers of two dancers.
Yeah, you know, especially for, you know, I've heard stories that Bob Fosse was an impeccable rhythmician?
I don't percussionist?
Even, I'm percussionist, maybe. I'm making up the word here. But they tell me that his time was impeccable, that he just had excellent rhythm. And you actually hear it in the songs mm-hmm. that were surrounded his combinations. You see it in his movement. It clicks. It's mm-hmm. precise. And there's drums underneath it. And I mean, just figuratively speaking.
Yeah.
So I just love that. There's something about the canon of work that those two performers had their hand in that resonated with me. And, you know, I often say that I will be the first person to tell you that I don't know this huge, huge, huge canon of Broadway scores like the back of my hand. But there's a certain energy about the shows that those people worked on that I'm like, oh yeah, those tunes mm-hmm. are killing. And that's music, just it really wakes something up in me. So being able to work on that amazing repertoire of music, I loved it.
What tools did you take from theater that you were able to apply to this television limited series?
Musical storytelling.
Yeah.
And, you know, to riff on that a little bit, it's, you know, I've now kind of been learning more and more that what I've been drawn to when I make arrangements and when I make orchestrations is charts and songs that make sure that the music itself tells a story just the way the lyrics do, just the way that the scene does, the action, the dance. You know, I'm very interested in having music feel like it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, that it has payoff, that it has emotional impact, and that it's not clever for clever's sake, that it's always supporting a story. There's a way that music, without any words at all, can evoke something and create a language and create a you know, just a narrative. So it just became important to me to, you know, pick themes that felt like they were appropriate to the characters, to make sure that the thread that got you in and out of a popular song like Big Spender just felt like it was all concurrent and part of the same, you know, that they were all made of the same wood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was, I think what I got out of theater is timing, especially, like, learning that there's always a way out of every puzzle, or every, you know, meaning there's always a solution to every puzzle. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I've got seven counts to get from point A to B, and maybe with a key change throughout it. And sometimes you'll rack your brain and bang your head against the wall trying to find out how you figure, you know, you're used to making eight counts and you're used to staying in one key. Now, how do you figure out this, you know, this little mathematical equation to create something? So that was a big thing, I think, that I was able to kind of bring from practicing it in theater and bringing it into a TV film world.
What's the mathematical equation for creating tension?
Wow.
Because that's a really important part of the their story.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. You know, for me, I mine dissonance, you know, uneasiness. I think for me, and sometimes there's, you know, for tension, like repetitive things are really good too, because if you're like stuck in a loop, like when's it going to change? What's it going to be? You know, you're kind of stuck in this little, you feel boxed in by it in a way. So that's one way you could create that. And as I mentioned, harmony is a big part of it as well. You know, there's a way that music can sound consonant and comforting and something you can relax into, but then you have to turn it on its ear to find a way to have it feel uneasy. Like, do you change the time signature for something odd instead of something even? Do you do a chord progression that goes a little bit more left of center and something that sounds a little more skewered to give a sense of something that doesn't feel resolved? You know, that's literally why they call it, resolution and tension. You find out where do you want that release? And there's a way to, I feel like there's a way to be able to create all those things that one would use in a story context with words and apply that to music and sound.
Aside from the obvious of it's a lot of time, What are the challenges of creating a soundscape for something like Fosse Verdon, which is 8 hours?
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, one of the things I thought about early on is, what is this show going to sound like? And that was a big question, because obviously the story takes place in very different time zones and time periods. Like, as you saw, our show goes from the 70s to the 50s to the 80s to the everything in between. I remember asking myself, okay, how modern are we going to go with this? Do we want to have it feel like it's classic, quote unquote? Do we want it to harken back to a different time? Do we want it to, like, just go, you know, have it really feel like it's today in 2019? I got the sense from watching the way it was being shot and watching the way it felt and seeing the dailies and being on set, they're like, okay, there's something about that, about this piece that's going to feel like it was made carefully with tools of today, but still talking about an earlier time. Mm-hmm. And episode one was the first one I started the score. And because that episode was all about cabaret, I wanted to try to use the sound of cabaret as the sound of that episode. So the instruments I chose tended to be kind of like jazzier and because it's funny, because like you're in 1972, but you're like also depicting 1939, 1940 Berlin. Where in what world do you live in? But because Sweet Charity was also part of that too, I felt like jazz was going to be a part of the vocabulary to the piece. There are times that we'll use some modern elements, like a drone that might pop in, some sound effects that might kind of like cloud things up a little bit, but in a way that didn't draw attention to itself, in a way that felt like it was still part of a world. Like, I can think of a cue in particular in episode one where it's Bob having a flashback, and you see him in Berlin in 1972, kind of looking across the room and seeing himself as a young child coming out of dance class. And because that felt like a dreamscape, and because that just felt like it was heightened, that felt like it gave me permission to use a modern sound, a modern pad or a drone, if you will, to be able to use that, but then use organic instruments around it, like a clarinet and a piano and an upright bass, and, you know, things that felt more like they were part of that particular, the era of the show that they were depicting. So really, you had to be all purpose, and that's why, you know, in those times, trying to be organic and trying to be quote unquote real is always going to benefit you, I think.
My guest is Alex Lacamoire, music composer, conductor, orchestrator extraordinaire. We're talking about his work on the FX series Fosse Verdon. We'll be back with more from Alex after the break. This is All of It. Yeah. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Tony and Grammy Award-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. Can we talk about In the Heights?
Yes.
I have such a strong personal connection to In the Heights. I may cry when I say this. my dad grew up on 143rd and 163rd Street.
Oh, amazing.
And I took him and my mom to see In the Heights, and it was the last time he was healthy.
Oh, wow.
And he got terminal cancer shortly after. Oh, my and he God. Had the best time.
Oh, that means so
it
much
felt
to
like
me.
His home, and he talked about it all the time.
Oh.
And when we cleaned out the house, they had kept the playbills.
Oh.
And it's just when I think about it, I get so warm.
That's really
it's
beautiful.
It's just a really, because of course he grew up there.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
of course.
Seeing it and felt like the neighborhood. And I can yeah. just, I can see his face in the audience oh. seeing it. So I want to know all about the movie.
Thank you so much for sharing that with me. That was really beautiful. And I will say this, my wife was born and raised in Washington Heights. And the view outside her apartment growing up was the view of our set on Broadway, which is like the bridge was right in front of her.
So cool.
And to be able to take my wife on set last week, you know, on 176th Street, you know, just off of Cabrini, for you know, for her to see her neighborhood glorified in this way, and
yeah.
for people in that neighborhood to see their neighborhood celebrated in that way. Like, I can't tell you how warm it feels for us. You were talking about warmth and love.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you feel it. And, you know, one of the things I love about Lin-Manuel Miranda's work is that you feel his love and his admiration for his subjects within the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain thing about, I don't know how to describe it, other than you hear music and then you can almost feel like you know the person who's writing it. There's sometimes music can sound cold, sometimes music can sound a little cerebral, but there's something about Lin's personality that comes through in his music that it is all heart, and there's a confidence and envelops you. You know, you feel Lin hugging you when you listen to his music. And that all it stems from the top down, because it infiltrates everything within the piece. So everyone around that, all those who work on his pieces, it always comes from a place of love and warmth. And so I think we're also feeling that in the neighborhood as I get, you know, as I drop in on set and see what they're filming and where they're filming it and how much fun people are having being there, how much goodwill that comes from John Chu, our director, how much joy there is from the people working on it, to the extras, to the neighbors walking down the street. People are really excited, and they're really directing positive energy into the piece in a way that is really just, it's being baked with love, and I can't explain it any other way.
I'm curious your thoughts on some of the sort of more progressive musicals that we're seeing, whether it be Hadestown
sure.
or the new version of Oklahoma, specifically the revivals, actually, I'm interested
mm-hmm.
in. How far can you go in changing something that's a classic?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, what's interesting about shows is that they are meant to be interpreted. Meaning what is left behind is a script and a score. And yes, you know, one can always prescribe and say, hey, this is how we saw it, right? This is how we did it. But at the end of the day, like, what it comes down to is words written on a page or notes on a staff, you know. Then what happens beyond then is up to the people involved putting it up on a stage. And there's always going to be ways to interpret things, and there's always going to be other people who see certain things in that text that we didn't when we were working on it. And I think that's what's wonderful about theater. You know, that's why we keep picking up Shakespeare's classics and finding another way to infuse life into them in a way that feels modern or accessible or whatever that is. You know, because there's something so magical about seeing live performers enact a story right in front of you. People pretending to be someone else and inhabiting a character so that we can go on a spiritual journey and be transcended. I mean, I love theater because of that, because there's a different energy you get from theater that you don't get from watching a film, I think. Because it's the vibrations are in the air. You know, you hear mm-hmm. that person's voice bellowing off a stage, and it's moving air in the room in a certain way that you experience it different than when it's coming out of, you know, an already existing a film cell or something. So for me, because there's always room for people to look for other avenues to get inside a piece, for highlight, a way for them to highlight something that they felt was important to them, as long as the spirit of the show is there, as long as the text is honored, as long as people don't mess with, like, okay, we're going to completely reorder the songs and reorder mm-hmm. the structure, that's when it gets a little too far. And then, you know, if people do that, then without the consent of the authors, you know, they're I would hope there's a good reason and there's a good goal in mind. I'm not going to say it can't be done, but that's where it starts to get a little tricky, because I think for me, I know I tend to respect what's on the page so much, and I will have ideas, but that's where I feel blessed. I collaborate with the people who created those words and created those sounds, so I could ask about, hey, what about this? What about that? Mm-hmm. And then it becomes something else. But I think to answer your question more succinctly, more power to those who feel like they can find another avenue to explore something and be able to make you see something within the piece that was maybe not highlighted before. So as long as it's done with respect, then I'm all for it.
Hamilton pushed a boundary. I think Book of Mormon pushed a boundary in musicals.
Sure. Absolutely.
I think Hadestown also pushes a boundary. Is there a boundary in musical theater you'd like to see pushed a little farther? Something you think, hey, why don't we try this? I mean, regardless, producers have to think about the bottom line. If there were no bottom line, what's a boundary that you would love to see pushed?
You know, I tend to love theater that takes chances. And I tend to love theater that just talks about a subject that maybe you thought you knew all about it, but here's another angle that you didn't. Topics that you didn't think could be made into a musical that are. I think at the end of the day, we see musicals because we want to hear cool stories. We want to find something that resonates with us, and in the end, find something that you see yourself in, something that makes you say, oh yeah, I totally get that. Or yes, I've lived that thing. Or yes, I've been in that situation. What would I have done? I think we're looking for ways to connect ultimately. So what I love is that people continuously find ways to surprise you and to find stories and narratives and things that might be, unexpected. And that's what I love. I know you mentioned Mormon, and I remember seeing workshops of that. I'm like, oh my God, like, I
what
can't
is
believe,
this?
What, how are people going to, like, there's going to be picket lines in front of the whole the theater every day. It just seems so outlandish. I'm like, oh my God, are they ever really going to put this on a stage? And my God, they did. And thank God they did, because it's one of the funniest musicals I've ever seen in my life. And that was something where it's like, oh my God, is this really going to work? And you never know. I think anytime you make art thinking that, oh, this is going to be a hit, you're like, oh, I'm making this because I'm looking to be the next XYZ, I think you're just painting yourself into a corner. And you got to make something because it feels true to you. You got to make something because this is what I want to say at this moment, because this is a statement I would like to put out in the world. This is what I'd like to give people to think about. But you got to make it for art's sake. You have to make it for that reason alone. And I think if your motives are something anything other than that, then you're going to be in for a surprise somewhere along the line.
That was my conversation with musical director and orchestrator Alex Lacamoire.